question?
So you.
Yes.
Okay, so all of this would apply to force-carrying particles like photons as well, right? This whole reformulation?
Say again?
Would your whole reformulation apply to force-mediating particles like photons?
Training, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Any other questions?
So the,
Yes.
You said that the vacuum is effectively doing the weak measurements on the charged particle.
Yeah.
And that's
the electromagnetic field.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Right.
And that's because you have the right. Well, that's because you have this linear form for the interaction.
That's right. It. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How generic? Like, does this effect constrain very strongly the type of interaction?
It what?
Does it constrain very tightly the type of interactions you can have, or is it the case that pretty much any interaction?
No. The point is. If we look at the most important interaction for describing everything that happens in our laboratory is the electromagnetic interaction. The electromagnetic interaction has the property that, you know, in the Lagrange is psi, dagger psi for the field, times a mu for the electromagnetic field. And a mu is linear in the coordinates of the harmonic oscillators of the different modes. So, therefore, for the most important interaction, that is the correct description. Of course, when you come to other interactions, gravitation or strong, then the linear approximation is not valid, but you will still get coupling that will change the degrees of freedom of the vacuum by less than its uncertainty. Otherwise, we will lose the coherence. So the fact that the interaction of, if we do any experiment, any quantum experiment, on any particle, neutron, electron, photon, as long as we see that we have a coherence between the different different directions before they interfere, that means that the interaction with all the environment, which in this case is the vacuum of all the fields, must be weak. Otherwise, we will lose the coherence. So the fact that we always have weak interaction, weak measurement, is general for every interaction. But for the electromagnetic field, it's very easy to calculate that interaction because it acts linearly in the field.
So you're saying even if it's nonlinear,
yeah, right.
It will still be
with measurement, but maybe more complicated to see how it works for different modes. Okay. Right. Any other question? Okay, let me remind you then what were the main thing we discussed last time. We showed that if we have an ensemble of particles, all of them described by the same state, a product for each particle that n goes from 1 to n, a product of n vectors for each individual particle. For simplicity, we take the same vector, although I've shown to you that it can be generalized even when this will be a product of different vectors. But suppose we come back to the idea that we have an ensemble of all of them described by the same state. And then we say that if we apply on this ensemble the operator sum of a individual an divided by n, that thing times that ensemble, we give up the result A average for individual particle, for each individual particle, times the ensemble, plus a correction delta psi, where the size of this vector, the remainder delta psi times delta psi, goes to zero as 1 over n. So if n is sufficiently large, we can say that if we couple a measuring device to this ensemble and the coupling is of this form, that the measuring device coupled to each individual particle very weakly by coupling strain that goes as 1 over n to each one of them, and it measures a n, then the pointer of this measuring device will move by a definite amount which is proportional to the average of A for each individual particle. And it's the same for all of them. And after the coupling to the measuring device, we know that the whole ensemble is left in the same state. If we do a final experiment after the interaction with the measuring device, we can check and see that indeed each one of these particles did not change, because the probability that even one of them will change goes to zero is 1 over n. So that means that after the measurement is over, we can go and do a post-reaction, and in the post-reaction we check whether each particle is still described by the same initial state. We find that indeed that is the case when n goes to infinity. All of them are still described by the same initial state after the measurement. So one particular post-reaction is indeed just checking that all of them are in the same initial state. So we have now the following thing. We have n particles, large number of them, this is time. All of them started with the same initial state, psi. This one started with psi, this one, etc. Now they evolve in time. Let me assume that I can neglect their free Hamiltonian for simplicity and just discuss what happened in the measurement. So each one of these particles evolves with the same state psi until intermediate time, when we come and couple each one of them to the same measuring device, and the coupling is very weak, and the measuring device gives us the answer A average, but each one of these particles continues afterwards with the same state. This is where the measurement happened. Because that measurement did not disturb even one of them, as we have proved, then each one of them continues to move with the same initial state, and now we are allowed to do now another post-selection at T final. And we can decide which post-selection we are going to do on this particle and interpret what happened to the measuring device here according to this post-selection. So the simplest post-selection at the end is indeed measure again psi, and then we find that each one of them at this point is exactly described by the same initial psi, because we forget about the free Hamiltonian. We just assume that the only change that can happen to psi is due to the interaction with the measuring device. But we are free now to do another. We can decide to do a different post-selection. We can decide to do here a measurement on each one of them by another measuring device that doesn't check if the state is psi, but it may check something else. So one natural thing to check is if we measure in the middle A, we can do at the end the measurement, a strong measurement that measures A for each one of them. So then we'll have a new post-selection. The post-selection will be some of them, suppose this operator A that we measured weakly, suppose it has a discrete set of eigenvalues, such as A times the state alpha n, gives us the answer alpha n times alpha n, but these are real eigenvalues. So if we do now a post-selection where we measure A for each one of them strongly now, then we'll get for some of them the answer alpha 1, for some of them the alpha answer alpha 2. So we'll have here, for example, here we'll get the state alpha 1. Here we'll get the state alpha 5, etc. So we can ask how many times do we get at the end the answer alpha 1, how many times we get the answer alpha 2. So we'll have, for example, we get n1 times the answer alpha 1, n2 times the answer alpha 2, etc. In the whole ensemble, then, we divided it according to those cases that we got alpha 1, those cases that we got alpha 2, etc. And now we use the ABL formalism, and we say, if for this particle, Because the answer alpha 1, we can take this vector and send it back on time, and we say what the measuring device saw when it interacted with this particle was the psi coming from here and the alpha 1 coming back from there. And therefore, in that case, the measuring device in the middle will move by alpha 1. Right? Why? Because if we look at what happens when we do a measurement, let me just remind you in general, how do we describe a measurement? We describe a measurement by assuming the following thing. The following thing. We have the system that we measure is described by psi, and we have a pointer or measuring device that is described by phi. Initially, they're in a product state. And now I assume that there is interaction between them that I call a measurement. That interaction, the result of that interaction, is described by a transformation which is e to the I pq. Let me assume that the measuring device state phi is describing a meter that has a coordinate q and a momentum pq. And, this phi initially, in the representation of q, this phi initially looks like something like that. It has some uncertainty in the position, and this is the wave function of the pointer initially. And what the measurement is supposed to do, if it's a good measurement, it's supposed to move this pointer by a distance that is proportional to the thing that we measure. And if it moves by much bigger than its uncertainty distance, then it will be a very good measurement, which we call strong measurement. Weak measurement is if this moves by something much less than its uncertainty, all right? But to describe it formally, we say that if we have the state initially for the measuring device is this one, and the state for the particle psi is an eigenstate of what we measure. So we want this to move by a distance proportional to the eigenvalue. So we write here formally a Fourier unitary time evolution operator, which is e to the I pq times the operator A times some strength lambda, or G. A transformation like this, what it does is the following. If psi is an eigenstate of A with the eigenvalue alpha, then this will become e to the I pq alpha times g when it acts on that. And then the effect of this phi will be to translate q, because this is the translation operator in the q, by alpha times g. So this is a formal, simple way to describe what happens in the measurement. We have a pointer, we have an operator that shifts the pointer by the amount that depends on the value that we measure. So for example, if the state psi is the sum an times alpha n, and we act with e to the I pqg, we act with e to the I g times pq times a on the state psi, which is sum over a n times alpha n, and on the state phi. Okay, this thing acts on the product. So when it acts on this thing, each one of those is an eigen state of a with the eigenvalue alpha n. Therefore, this can be written as the sum of a n, alpha n, e to the I, pq, and instead of a, and g pq, and instead of a, we now put the value alpha n, and that acts on the state phi. So the, then the result will be a sum of AN, alpha N, and here we have the vector phi N, where phi N is the pointer shifted by the value alpha N. So if G is sufficiently strong, what we will see here is the pointer either staying here if alpha is equal to 0, or moving if alpha is equal to 1, it will move a distance G. If alpha is equal to 2, suppose the eigenvalues are 1, 2, or 3, it will move to a distance. So we have now entanglement between the system that we started and the measuring device. We see the measuring device in all these locations. And the amplitude of getting each one of these is an, so the probability of each one of these is absolute value of an squared. So this is what happens when we have a good measurement, a strong measurement. But instead, if G is very small, we'll see here a situation now where the measuring device pointer is either this or this shifted by a very small amount or by another small amount, and we can get interferences between those, and that will be all the interesting things that happen when the measurement is weak measurement. Okay, so coming back now, is there any questions about this? Okay, so now we come back to what happens here. So in this, for this first particle, we started with the state psi, and we ended up here with the value alpha n. So therefore, what happened in the middle here, we have to take the time evolution operator, which is equal to the I, g, where z now is very small, times pq for the measuring device, times a for the particle, and we put here the initial state psi, we put here the final state alpha 1 say, and then what will happen to the measuring device will be shifted by the value alpha 1 in this case, right? But a small shift. So therefore, the thing that tells us what will happen to the measuring device after it interacts with all the particles will be that its pointer, where is the, we remember we started with the measuring device with this wave function for the pointer q. It comes, we interact with the first particle, it shifts by a very small amount, which is proportional now to alpha 1, if we post-select alpha 1. Then it shifted by another small amount that's proportional to alpha 2 for the second one. Altogether, the total shift will be n1 times alpha 1, plus n2 times alpha 2, plus nn times alpha n. Suppose there are only a finite number of eigenvalues. But we have to divide by n here, because the coupling strength for each one of them was proportional to 1 over n. So the g is 1 over n. So the shift for each one of them is alpha 1 divided by n, because the shift was alpha 1 times g. So we see now that this result must be equal to A average, to what we call A average. A average was what happened to the pointer of the measuring device after it interacted with all the particles. It shifted by A average. But this A average is not a true average. This is just, remember, this is a mathematical thing that happened for each individual particle. Remember how we got this A average, so-called A average. It wasn't because we calculated something statistically. This is very, very important. I remind you how we got this thing for the measuring device. We used our magic formula that A times psi is equal to A average times psi plus delta A times some orthogonal state to psi. This was our general formulation. Now, this thing that happens here, that we call average, has nothing to do with the true average. It's just a mathematical statement that the thing that happened here is equal to psi a psi, where this thing so far has no connection with statistical statement. It's a mathematical statement that is true for individual system, that what multiplies here is this quantity. So far, it has no connection to statistics. So what happens here, what is put here is this psi a psi, that so far we didn't connect it with any statistic. But now suddenly, we find that there is a connection to statistics. Here we get psi a psi from the property of just Hilbert space. No connection with measurement. Here we get now connection to measurement. We get that this value, that is a property in Hilbert space of just individual vector, is equal to that sum. And lo and behold, we got from this the Born rule, because we have shown now that the sum of a probability to get alpha 1 plus probability to get alpha 2 plus probability to get alpha n, these are definition of probabilities in experiment, that this is equal to this number here. And because it's equal to this number here, we can now prove that these probabilities must be equal to the coefficient that multiply, that if I write psi as a sum of a n alpha n, then we prove from this now that the probability to get alpha n is indeed equal to a n absolute value squared. This is amazing, because we can prove now, just based on weak measurement and on this mathematical property here, that the Born rule must be satisfied. I want to stop here because it's so important. I want to make sure that you all understand how it happened. Because if I can show that the sum of this is equal to this thing for any psi, then I can show immediately that n1 over n must be equal to the coefficient of expansion here, absolute value squared. This is not trivial, so let me prove it to you. If I look at what this quantity psi times a psi is, if I write psi as a sum of a n times eigenvectors of A alpha L, then this thing is equal to the sum of A n star alpha N times the vector A times alpha N, and there will be A n star times A n. So it's trivial to show that psi a psi is simply the sum of a n absolute value squared times alpha a. This is just mathematics, right? Because a times psi gives me alpha n times psi, and the coefficient becomes a n squared. So this thing indeed is equal to the sum of a n squared alpha n, right? So I've now shown that the number of times I get alpha 1, the number of times I get alpha 2, etc., is equal to that sum for any state. Then the only way that it can happen is if n squared is equal to the probability. You see that? It's not trivial. On one hand, I got from the ABL, I got this thing, that this sum, the number of times I got L, alpha 1, the number of times I got alpha 2, etc., the sum of it is equal to that quantity. But that quantity is equal to the sum of A n squared times alpha n. So the only way for every state this thing must be equal to that, then the only way it can happen is A n squared is equal to n to the number of times I get it. So I was able to prove the bound rule just based on dynamics. Dynamics where I have one system interact weakly with this ensemble, which I call a pointer. That system on the other, on one hand, gave me a shift which is equal to this quantity. So far this quantity is not interpreted in any way statistically. But then when I come and do a post-selection, and I post-select on each one of these particles in the ensemble an eigenvalue of A, then I find that the result by ABL is equal to that thing. And that thing must be equal to that quantity. The only way it can happen is if each one, or if each number n divided by n is equal to the amplitude square here. So I was able to prove the bound rule just based on dynamics, without any assumption at all. I must stop here. I see that not everybody understands me yet. Yes?
In order to prove that you needed to use...
Sorry?
In order to prove that you needed to use the ABL formalism.
Yeah.
But isn't the... Aren't you using the Born rule implied that to...
No, I did not use the Born rule for the ABL formalism.
And that's the post-selection program.
What?
Where does the probability of the post-selection...
That's exactly what I calculated. I've proven. I'm saying that, again, that's exactly what I proved, that I can prove that it must be that. I don't assume it. Okay, so you're, it's good because that shows that you that my point is still mixed, okay? So let me again explain what I'm doing here. I'm saying that I start with n large number of particles, all of them start by the same shape size. Okay, up to now, there's no mystery. I can certainly start with as large number of particles as I like, or we have to start by psi. Now I have time evolution. For simplicity, I assume that the free Hamiltonian is equal to zero, because that is just, it's irrelevant for the discussion. So each one of these particles now, in time, is described by the same state psi. Now I come with a single other particle I call measuring device, and interact with it weakly with each one of them. And I find that as a result of this interaction, the pointer of this particle, this what I call measuring device, is shifted by an amount that is proportional to some coupling G times a quantity, I will not call it A right now, G times the state psi A psi. This is a statement that I can prove as a dynamical statement. Namely, I have shown that if I have a coupling of the form e to the I, g, times pq for the measuring device, times a for the particle, for an individual particle, divided by n, and I have a sum of these, right? If the first particle coming, I shift it by an amount g divided by n times this quantity. Right? For the second particle, the same thing for the third. Therefore, each one of these particles shifts at the measuring device by a very small amount. So let me come with the measuring device that just with this particle alone. The pointer wave function was initially that. After it interacts with the first particle, it shifts by a definite amount, very, very small amount, which is an amount which is equal to the quantity psi a psi divided by n. This is what happened after interacting with the first one, and some g, a finite number. And remember, this thing, I have proven that thing not knowing anything about statistics, just dynamical statement. Because the proof was based on the fact, let me prove it again, so it's so important. I look at the operator e to the I, g times a divided by n times pq. This is my unitary time evolution, an interaction between one particle and the measuring device. And I multiply it by the initial state of the particle, which is psi, and the initial state of the measuring device, which is phi. Now I want to calculate what this is based on no assumption about statistics. This is just a mathematical transformation in Hilbert space. All right? Now, because this is so weak, I can write it as 1 plus ig times a divided by n times pq times psi times phi. And I select higher order terms because this is higher order terms will be 1 over n squared, and I can select them. And now I use my magic formula to say that when I apply with A to psi, I get A average psi plus a correction that I can neglect. So this will become 1 plus IG PQ over N multiplied by this quantity, psi A psi. Right? Remember, because the operator A times psi in general is equal to psi A psi times psi plus a correction delta A times psi orthogonal. But the thing that multiplies psi is this quantity. This is just the thing that I've proven, right? And it has nothing to do with statistics. So therefore I know now that after the interaction, the pointer, the particle was left in the same state, and the pointer was moving by the value psi A psi divided by N multiplied by G. This is after the first one. Then after interact with N of them, the N disappears, and the pointer was moving by this quantity times G, where I didn't assume anything about statistics. This is just dynamic statement about Hilbert space. So I don't know anything about statistics here. Okay. So now you know that if I look at my pointer at the end, it was shifted by a distance, which is G times the quantity psi A psi. For each one, we were moving by a very small amount, but for all of them together, we were moving by G, G is like 2 or 3, G times that quantity. All right? Now I want to see that I can calculate what happened to it in a different way by using the ABN. I say now the following. Look what happened. Yeah?
I don't see why you mentioned ABL. You're not using ABL. All you're doing is measuring weakly this operator A, and then you're going back and measuring with a strong measurement A on each subsystem. There's no ABL.
No, but when I do the strong measurement, I want to see, I can use either ABL or I can use the entanglement, and then the
but ABL raises the question.
Huh?
Well, no, you will not use that. You just say how many areas.
What?
No.
I look at it as a proxy action. Look, initially I have each one of these particles described by the same evolving psi, right? Etc. Now I do here the coupling to the measuring device, and the measuring device is shifted by this amount, psi psi, right? And the particles are left here at the same initial state. Okay? Nothing happened to it. Now I can come on this particle and do a post-selection by making strong measurement.
Yeah. Now you're measuring strongly what you measured weakly.
Yeah, okay, but when I measure strongly, I ask now, there are two ways that I can do it. I prefer to do it, to look at it in this way, because I want to generalize it later for other weak values, okay? So let me do it my way.
I mean, it's not
ABL. Huh? What?
No.
I'm just saying that if I, for example, if I find this as the state alpha 1, I can say that if I go back in time, I find your alpha 1 here, and I find you the same psi here, then I can calculate what happens here on that basis, and we'll find that in this case, the measuring device was moved by the weak value, which in this case is simply equal to alpha 1. It's a special case, because I want to use the same thing later for other possibilities where this would have been an eigenstate, okay? So let me do it this way. I can do it this way, it doesn't matter. Agree?
Yeah.
Okay, so what happens now? I find the following. When I do this post selection and send it back in time, I find that there will be n1 times where I got at the end the answer alpha 1. For those cases, I know that the measuring device is moved by a distance alpha 1 times z divided by n. So therefore, I say that from this point of view, the shift of the pointer will be a sum of nn times alpha n divided by n times z. Right? This will be the shift of the pointer from when I do this strong postulation. And this must be equal to psi a psi times z. So the z cancel. And I find now this equality. Nn alpha n divided by n is equal to psi a psi. And I learned that from this I can prove the Born rule. Because only this thing here is proportional to alpha n times the absolute times the amplitude square, and this is alpha n times the number of times I wrote it. So the number of times must be equal to, must be proportional to the amplitude square, absolute value square. So I proved it this way, the Born rule, just using dynamics. Okay, you agree now? I did not have to assume it, I wrote it, the number of times that I wrote. This is very important. Remember that my whole motive is to start with just the change in dynamics from Poisson bracket to commutator and being able to show that everything else follows just from the change in dynamics. So here I found already one nice example where that dynamical consideration lead me to the important features of the basic axiom of quantum mechanics, that the probability to get an answer is proportional to the amplitude value square. Okay? This is an example where I can prove something by just using dynamics. Okay. Are there any questions about that? Yes.
You assume here that operators A and P Q commute.
That what?
That they commute, operators A and P sub Q. Did you assume that?
Which operator A?
Well, you have an operator A and P sub Q.
A is on the system,
P sub Q.
Well, there could be some interaction, right? Although it's weak.
No, the interaction is between, I have interaction between two systems. One system is described by psi, and it has an operator A in it, and the other system, a different system, is the measuring device that is described by Q and PQ. And certainly the operator describing the measuring device commutes with the operator describing the system. That's when I have one system. When I have many systems, their operators commute with each other. So everything commuting here.
Everything commuting, there is no time.
Yeah.
Time.
No, because they are all different degrees of freedom. For each individual system, I have just a single operator. So there is no problem, no issue of commutation. Any other question? Yes?
How do you get that factor?
Speak loudly, please. Oh,
how
somebody
do you get
will.
That? Sorry. How do you get that factor n, like n sub n?
Huh?
Because n sub n is
what?
Like after you interact with the meter, right?
N sub n is the number of times I got the answer alpha n. Each one of them contributes to a shift by g over n, because that was the coupling strength. The coupling strength to each one of them was g divided by n. A particular one that gave me the alpha, the value alpha n, shifted the measuring device by distance g over n. Then I have a finite number of them that gave me, so they all contribute to the total shift by the time they got the answer alpha n multiplied by g over n. Okay?
So I have a question. Next time when you measure it's a strong measure.
Yeah.
So then why I see G? Why I see G again when you are doing the strong measure?
No, when I do the strong measurement, I get simply alpha 1. But then when I ask, based on this, I come back and ask what happened here. What happened here was a shift now, not by G times psi psi, but G times alpha 1 divided by n. I'm asking what happens to the measuring device if I know that the post reaction is alpha already. Then the measuring device now, I know now that for this individual particle, when the measuring device interacted here, it was shifted by an amount proportional to the strength of the coupling, which is G over N, multiplied by now by alpha 1. Okay?
No. I think, thank you.
Yes?
I think the answer to the question is this is the first measurement.
A what?
First measurement. This is the measurement device is coupled to that, if you consider. But the second measure is just a post-selection.
Yeah.
That's the process is, it's an adding point, I think to be pointed out. Why do not consider that the second measurement device is? Why do not consider?
No, because the second interaction doesn't involve the measuring device. It only looks at the particle. The measuring device is already fixed.
There is a measuring device in the middle.
Yeah.
And there are other measuring devices to the end.
Yeah.
Those are just the deep what they gave.
Yeah, then it's finally, if we can get the same answer. That's correct. Yes.
I don't understand.
The measurements at the end are strong. But,
yes.
But the sum of the results measured from them must agree with the
weak
value measured intermediate.
Yeah.
Okay, I suggest that you think about it, and if you don't understand, ask me later. Let me summarize what we have known so far. We have known so far is the fact that if I have an ensemble of particles, all of them are described by the same state psi. And I do a measurement that interacts very weakly with each one of them, and the interaction is for each one of them is the same operator A, with the strength of interaction that is proportional to some finite number divided by the total number of particles. Then, just using that formula, A times psi is equal to A1 psi plus A2 psi orthogonal. Well, this A1 that is equal to psi A psi, so far it has no connection with statistics at all. It's just a mathematical statement in Hilbert space. Then, just based on this formula, I was able to show that the interaction of this single measuring device with the whole ensemble, where the interaction is proportional to the interaction strength is G over N, the pointer of the measuring device was shifted by G times this quantity. So far, no mention of statistics at all. This is not interpreted as average. It's simply a mathematical statement in what happens to operators in Hilbert space. All right? Now, I come and say, okay, because the particles have no change, I can do now on them post-selection. And I post-select how many of them ended up with the value alpha, with the state alpha 1, how many of them ended up with the state alpha 2, where these are eigenstates of the operator A. And therefore, I know that I can calculate now the shift of the measuring device in a different way. I calculate by saying, if I got n1 times the value alpha 1, then for those, the shift of the measuring device was equal to n1 divided by the total number times g times alpha 1. And therefore, the total shift of the measuring device can be now shown to be equal to the sum of nn, the number of times I got the eigenvalue alpha n, divided by n times g. And I was able to calculate dynamically that this must be equal to g times psi a psi. So, from this I can show now that psi a psi must be the average of A. Because here I see the average of A. And because of this, I can prove the Born rule, because the only way that the two things can equal to each other is the number of times that I get the particular value is equal to the, from this thing, is equal to the absolute value square of the coefficient of expansion. So this is already a nice result. Just using the weak measurement, I was able to prove that the Born rule must be satisfied without making any separate assumption. It's not a separate axiom. I just have the dynamics, the definition of dynamics. I make coupling from two systems using the Hamilton, the Heisenberg equation of motion. I was able from this to prove the Born rule. That's a good place to stop now, and then we'll continue after intermission. Questions? Yes.
So maybe just the one step you skip. You need to find out the equation there in time. It's like 1 plus g n over a raised to the n for each of the particles, and then all of them make the shift of g a
n. Yeah, I do it in time. I don't have the other, but because I assume that the free Hamiltonian is zero, the time doesn't play a role. So I do it one after the other and collect the final shift and see that I can collect the final shift in two different ways. One, by each time I get the shift by the so-called average, the other is that I have n one times one shift. And yeah, I do it in time, but it doesn't matter. I can do it as one interaction with all of them or one after the other. Okay.
But there is something else that is hidden, the fact that you take the scalar product with the final state. So that is, if you want to see the shift at each of them,
yes.
You take the scalar product with the final state.
No, I do that. I use what I have proven in the, that's why I use the ABL. I assume the ABL. In the ABL format, I show this. My pre-selection is psi 1, post-selection psi 2. I do some experiment in middle, I use both of them on equal footing as scalar product. So in the ABL, I have proven it. So that's why I'm using it here. Okay. Now, so I have shown that there are two, in this business, I have two, up to now, two very natural post-selections. One, I post-select on each one of them psi. Check whether it's psi or not psi. I find that on all of them it's psi, and each one of them is fixed as a measuring device exactly by psi a psi times g over n. Instead, I can do another natural post-selection, and that post-selection according to eigenvalue of a, eigenfunction of a. That's another natural post-selection, and then I find that those that ended up with alpha particular alpha shifted the measuring device not by psi psi, but each one of them now shifted it differently. Instead of by psi psi, they shifted it by alpha 1, alpha 2, by alpha 2. So how is it possible? Already in the present I see that the shift depends what I'm going to do a postulate in the future. But because there is no way on individual particles to check what is the shift, because it's much smaller than the uncertainty, this is no violation of causality or no violation of free will, but we discuss this carefully later, okay? All right, now, a third possibility, now a very general one, I can do now on the post-selection, measure another operator, not A, and not an operator for which psi is an eigenvector, but some other operator that has eigenvector phi n. So suppose I now look at a new operator b, an operator b that has a complete set of eigenstates beta n, so that this is equal to beta n times beta n, because these are single real numbers because they are eigenvalues of Hermitian operators. I ask what happens now if I do this post-selection and go back and find out how did my measuring device in the middle shifted according to this post-selection. So again, I use the ABL formulation and ask what happens if I got here a particular eigenvalue beta 1 eigenvector beta 1 when I measure B. And ask now, if I got this thing, what happens in the middle here? If I use ABL formulation, what happened to the shift of the measuring device with these two boundary conditions, psi from here and beta 1 from there, beta from there. So what do I have to do? I look at again at my time evolution operator for the measuring, which is e to the I g over n pq times a. And I have here my initial state psi and the measuring device state phi. And I post-select now the particular beta, say beta 1. And ask now, if I post-select from this one, what will be the shift of the measuring device? So I have to calculate what is this thing first and see what is left as an operator that acts on phi. And again, I use the fact that this is a very, very small number, so I can take the first order expansion and write this thing as beta 1 times 1 plus I g over n pq a. Time the state psi. And what is left here will act on phi. So I want to calculate that thing here. So I can write it as beta 1 times psi. And inside, I will have 1 plus I g over n pq times beta 1 beta 1 a psi divided by beta 1 psi, right? Because I had to calculate beta 1 a psi, but because I took this thing out, here I have the 1, but here I have to divide by that thing. So this is exactly to first order in this expansion what happened to the thing that still has two action phi, right? Now, this is a number, and I call this number weak value. So let me define beta 1 a psi divided by beta 1 psi. Let me define it to be the weak value of a given this, so I will call it the weak value of a 1. The idea here is that this is calculated by assuming that I started with the state psi and ended up with the state beta 1, okay? So this number, I can now say that what this is equal to is 1 plus I g over n pq times a weak 1. And this has to act on phi. Now, because this is small, I can exponentiate it again and say that this is equal to e to the I g over n pq times a weak 1 acting on phi. And this is a shift operator on the measuring device pointer, now not by eigenvalue of a, not by the average of a, but by this new number, a weak. So now the pointer of the measuring device, when I do this post-selection on the first particle, will be shifted here, again by a very small amount, but this small amount now will be not eigenvalue of a, not the average of a, but a new number, which is a weak And I can say now that if I do this for all the particles, I will have here a sum of n1 over n times a with n and times g. And that sum will be now the shift, the total shift of the measuring device, which is still equal to a average, the same psi a psi. So I now can see that I can interpret that measuring device shift as due to contribution from each individual particle that depend on the pre and post selection and give me this mysterious new kind of value as a physical property of the particles that have been pre and post selected. And remember that I could have guessed that that's what should happen in the following way. I remind you how I was guessing that this should be the case, because I said, let us look at the quantity psi a psi. That is the shift up to, that's the shift of the measuring device. It is due to the fact that I have many, many particles that all of them started with this psi and all of them ended with psi. But now I can do the following mathematical thing. I can put here a complete set of eigenvectors for some other operator, b. We know that this complete set, when I sum it over n, is equal to the unit operator. So I can stick it here and have here psi, a times psi. This is still equal to psi epsilon, to the so-called average. But now I can multiply and divide by beta and psi and write the thing I can now write psi epsilon as the sum over n of psi beta n times beta n psi times beta n a psi divided by beta n psi. This is still equal to what happens to the shift of the measuring device. What is the interpretation of this formula? Because my weak measurement did not change psi, I say that if I measure at the end beta, that now I'm proving is the probability to get the number of times I get beta n. I've proven it already. And therefore, what this tells you is that I can think about the average of A is being made out of the number of times I got one of them times this mysterious number. The number of times I got another. So instead of A values that usually I say, I get the average of A by getting the number of times I got one value of A divided by N plus the number of times I got another value, which is the probability to get eigenvalues. Now I have a probability to get pre and post selection. This is the probability to get a particular pre and post selection. And each one of these things contributes now this new kind of physical property that I call weak value. And I can say then that what happens when I interact weakly with a single particle that starts with a state psi and ends it up with another state beta, that interaction between the measuring device and this particular pre and post selected situation, the measuring device experiences an effect which is proportional, while the weak measurement proportional to this new physical value. So this is a true physical property. It's a physical property of a particle, a quantum system that is pre and post selected, provided it interacts with something else weakly. So this is even more general than measurement. I can say each time I have a quantum system, and this quantum system interacts with the environment weakly, with everything else weakly. And I'm doing this system in pre and post selection. then the environment will experience the effect of this system as if it has a value which is the weak value. And we'll have more to say about that. So we now have a new interpretation, a new kind of physical property of a system. The physical property is not eigenvalue, and it's not average. It's a new value that I call weak value. And this weak value, being a physical property, has very interesting features. The first important feature is that thing, suppose A is an operator that has a finite size on it. Suppose it's a projection operator or a spin-like operator that is limited in value. It can be either 0 or 1 if it's a projection operator, or it can be 1 or minus 1 if it's a spin operator. I look now at this situation and I find because I divide here by a number that is extremely small, if beta n is nearly orthogonal to psi, I get that the weak value can be completely outside the range of the eigenvalue, can be much bigger. So it suggests that there is hidden here a possibility of doing, by playing post-selection of the right kind, we can do amplification. And that is the thing that is now being found in many laboratories, a very interesting possibility of doing experiments where you do pre-post-selection. You do pre-post-selection so that in most of the cases you don't get it, but in the time that you get it, you get an effect that is much stronger than the usual one. Okay? That we will again have more about it to discuss later. But let me discuss some important features of that property. For example, if A, the operator A, can be written as the sum of A1 plus A2, two-dimensional operator, and I have the pre-selection is psi 1 and the post-selection is psi 2, and I want to calculate the weak value of A, it will be A1 plus A2 divided by psi 2 psi 1. Now suppose psi 1 is an eigen vector of A1 and psi 2 is an eigen vector of A2. So then this will be simply equal to alpha 1 plus alpha 2, where alpha 1 is the eigen value for A1 and alpha 2 is the eigen value for A2. So the weak value of a sum of two operators is equal to the sum of the eigenvalues if each one of the psi is an eigenvector of the operators. That is important because now I come back to our original starting point. You remember why did I look for this measurement? Let me remind you. I was starting with the ABL formula and I said, of the ABL of looking at things, and I said, I have here a spin half particle that started with sigma is equal to 1. And everything that the filament term is 0, no magnetic field. So this is a constant motion. This particle, if this is time, is described all the time by the state sigma x is equal to plus 1. This is the time evolution state from here. Now I do a post selection with sigma y equal to plus 1. And I say I can send it back in time. And say now that in the time in between, the part is described now by two properties, that sigma x is equal to 1 and sigma y is equal to 1. And I was looking for a way to see that these both things are there. And I said, if both things are there, then maybe sigma x1, sigma x plus sigma y, should give me, under this condition, the value 2. And remember, that is an impossible value if I do a strong measurement, because if I divide by square root of 2 here, this is just a spin component in 45 degrees. It can have only the values of 1 minus 1, never the value square root of 2. But then I realized the reason why I can't get it is because any measurement that I will do in the middle to measure sigma x that sigma y will definitely destroy each one of them, because it will be a magnetic field in the 45 degrees that will change exactly what I'm trying to measure. So I said, maybe if I will find a way to do a weak measurement that doesn't change any one of them, I will get a value of 2, or square root of 2 here. And now we have proven it, because we have shown that the weak value, the thing that that the measuring device indeed will shift when I do a weak measurement, is if I start with the state sigma x equal to plus 1. Put here sigma x, the operator sigma x plus sigma y. And put here the state sigma y equal to plus 1, the final state. Then I show you the weak value of this thing indeed is equal to 2. Because the weak value is this divided by the product of sigma y and sigma x. This will give me 1 when it acts on that. This will give me 1 when it acts on that. So this denominator is cancelled by the top, and I get just indeed the value 2. So now, indeed, I have shown that if I have a large number of particles, that all of them started with the state sigma x equal to plus 1. And all of them ended with the state sigma y equal to plus 1. It's a rare experiment, but can happen. Then, if I do coupling with measuring device that measures sigma x plus sigma y for each one of them weakly, then the result of the shift of the measuring device will indeed be equal to 2 times, or square root of 2 times the number of particles. Each spin contributes square root of 2 rather than 1. Because I've done weak measurement and I found these weak values. So this proves that the intuition that we got from the new way of looking at physics, the quantum mechanics, by using both pictures, that new way suggested that we should got this value, and indeed now we are proving that we get it. Now, after we have shown it, of course, we can forget about the two vector formulation. Do the calculation just using the usual approach, we'll get the same answer. But the usual approach of just describing everything by one vector would have never suggested even to ask this question, and the result of getting the two will be a very surprising result. It will be like a miracle, while from the point of view of the two vectors, it's automatically explained. And in order to show how this miracle happens, I want to introduce now something that I was led to discuss from that point of view, something that I call quantum walk. I want to show how to understand this miracle of getting these new possibilities in a general concept that I call quantum walk, and I want to show you how this works. Let us think about the classical problem. I have a position x here. And I do classically the thing that is called random walk. Namely, I have a classical particle that starts at the point x equal to 0. I throw a coin. If the coin comes up, I shift the particle distance delta L in this direction, and if the coin comes in the other side, I shift the particle, I make the particle go one step delta L in the other side. And the question is now, what happens when I repeat this experiment n times? So you all know I will have the Poisson distribution. The thing, the probability of getting the maximum distance, which is n times delta L, is equal to 1/2 to the power n, if I succeed all the time to get. So the maximum distance this classical particle will go will be L, where L is equal to N times delta L. But this will be exponentially small probability if N is very large, up to the power L. And I have a distribution like this. The spread here is of the order of square root of N times delta L. And it goes then exponentially down to zero if N is very large. And it ends up definitely at distances which are delta L times N here and minus delta L times N here. That is the classical random walk. Now suppose I want to generalize this concept to quantum mechanics. So the way to generalize it, to do two things. First, I will make the thing that works, not a point, but instead a wave function. So now my worker will be a quantum particle that is described initially by some, say, wave packet like this. And I want to have a quantum coil. A quantum coil is something that still can give me either answer 1 or minus 1, but now the probability that will come out with this coin will be a quantum probability. How do I do that? I assume that the particle has a spin half also, and suppose I start the spin of the particle at sigma h equal to plus 1, which is sigma z equal plus 1 plus sigma z equal minus 1 divided by square root of 2. And I say I now find some interaction that applies to this particle, that if sigma z is equal to plus 1, it moves to the right by distance delta l, and if sigma z is equal to minus 1, it will move to the left by delta l. And the probability to get any one of these now is 1/2, and this is a perfect coin. You see, a classical coin can be, you know, you can cheat on a classical coin. But in quantum mechanics, there is no cheating. Number of times you will get this one, number of times you get this one is exactly half times with two probability. Okay, so how do I keep this physically? Well, here's the idea. I want to find a way to make the particle move a step delta L to the right if sigma z is equal to plus 1, and delta L to the left if sigma z is equal to minus 1. The way to do it is the following. Suppose the particle is moving with some very high velocity, average velocity. The average velocity is very large compared to the uncertain velocity, so the particle moves for a long time and can exert its spread. And the particle comes now to a place here where there is an homogeneous magnetic field in the z direction. If there is a homogeneous magnetic field in the z direction, if spin is down in the z direction, the tapping then will be minus mu times sigma z times this bz. Bz is a constant. So the particle sees u in this region of space, it sees a potential. The potential is positive or negative depending on whether sigma z is plus or minus. So if the particle has very high velocity, the probability of reflection is negligible, it will simply move a little bit slower if the potential is up, a little bit higher if the potential is down. So I can arrange that when the wave packet arrives here, compared to no magnetic field, it will be shifted, and I want the distance to be very small compared to the width, will be shifted this way or this way, depending on the value of sigma z. Now you can go to a frame of reference where the particle is at rest and the magnet is moving. So I have a particle at rest, the magnet is moving very quickly here, and after it finishes, the particle that was shifted by distance delta L if sigma z is equal to plus 1, and by distance minus delta L if sigma is equal to minus 1, right? Okay. So after one step, if I start the particle in state psi, after one step I say that I have sigma z. Okay. I start initially with the state sigma e equal to plus 1 times psi of x. Psi. Psi is just the wave function of the coordinate. The particle has a coordinate x and the spin sigma. This psi expanded in position representation is this wave function, and it has a spin sigma is equal to plus 1. Now I apply a time evolution operator, which is I px times sigma z times delta l. So I know that this operator shifts psi, but plus delta psi of x will go. So the whole thing can be written now as sigma z equals to plus 1 times psi of x plus delta l plus sigma z equals to minus 1 times psi of x minus delta l where I do a mixture. The psi I write as a wave function, but remember this is really equal to the integral of psi times eigenstate of position. But let me write it like this, divided by square root of 2. So I see now that I get sort of very weak entanglement. It's sigma z is equal to plus 1. I get psi shifted slightly to the left, and sigma z is equal to minus 1, the psi shifted slightly to the right by delta L, okay? Now I do post-selection. I do a post-selection by making a measurement where I make a measurement that one of the outcomes of this measurement is cosine theta times sigma z equal to plus 1 plus I do a post-selection on the state sigma z equal to 1 times cosine theta plus sigma z equal to minus 1 times sine theta. And I post-select this state. Then I do a measurement on which there are two possibilities. Either this vector as an outcome or the orthogonal vector minus sine theta times sigma z plus cosine theta times sigma e. And suppose I got this answer and I ask now what happens to the measurement in this case. So my particle that was initially described by psi of x times sigma x equal to plus 1 is now goes to the state psi of x plus delta L times cosine theta plus sine theta times psi of x minus delta L. If I do succeed in this post-selection, right? Because when I multiply this state from the left with this thing, I get sigma z equal to plus 1 times sigma z equal to plus 1 gives me 1 times cosine theta, so I get cosine theta times z, and this times z gives me 0, then this times z gives me 0, this times z gives me sine theta. So I get indeed this, what happened to the particle after the magnet passes by and do the post selection, it will be described by this wave function. Even Sandro is confused for a bit.
No.
Huh?
I was a guy.
Everybody sees it? Okay.
There's a question.
In this post-election, the second term is supposed to also be a bra, right?
Okay.
In this post-election, the second term is also a bra, not a cat.
I'm not sure I understand.
Yeah, post-election.
On this particular state.
The next one is a cat, though. Huh? It should be a bra, right?
Huh?
Move your hand 30 centimeters.
Sigma z equal to 1 times sine theta.
That should be a bra.
A what?
A bra. Ah,
yeah, yeah, sure, sure. Okay. Yeah, you're right. Definitely. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I meant that thing. Okay? So if I post-select on this, I get this thing, which in fact, can be written as, let me see, if I write, I want to write it as e to the I px times a number, that you will see the number will be sigma z with times delta L times the initial state psi. Let me prove that indeed what happened after one step, if I do this pre and post selection, is really shifted psi by this weak value. Let us see if this is correct. I can write this as cosine theta times e to the I px delta L plus sine theta times e to the minus I px delta n times psi. Right, this is a shift operator by delta n, this is a shift operator by minus delta n. So again, as I explained, if delta n is very small, or pf times delta n is very small, that means that I shift by much less than uncertainty, I can take only first order of this. So this is the cosine theta times 1 plus I pf delta n plus sine theta times 1 minus I pf delta n times psi. So I see here I have here cosine theta plus sine theta for the constant thing, so I will take it out of the bracket and we get cosine theta plus sine theta multiplied by 1 plus I delta L cosine theta minus sine theta divided by cosine theta plus sine theta. Right? And you see, I
you left out the operator PX.
Times P, yeah, right. Thank you. Yeah, because here, when I add the PX is multiplied by cosine theta, I, there is an I there, yeah. I times cosine theta minus I times sine theta PX delta A. And I took out cosine theta plus sine theta, I have to divide. And I said that this quantity is the weak value of sigma z if I do a pre-post selection. So in this one step, the measuring device, the quantum worker, moved by the weak value of sigma z after one step, right? And, okay? Well, this is sigma z weak. I want to know now what happens after I do n steps like this. And you will see that because this thing can be larger than one, after if I'm successful in n steps to get all the time the same value, I will get this miracle that the quantum particle, because I interfere the possibility of making move to the right and making move to the left, I actually enable it to go a distance much bigger than the classical distance. Because the distance that it will move after n steps will be n times times this single step. And this single step is delta L multiplied by a number that is larger than 1. And therefore this quantum particle in this quantum walk. So let's repeat what happened. I have a quantum particle which is described by a wave packet like this. I say, I throw my quantum coil. If it comes up, it shifts to the right. It shifts by delta L to the right, meaning after it shifts to the left. Or if I get the opposite thing, it shifts to the left. I would have expected that if I want to get the maximum shift, I should add all the time that shift to the right. But that's not true. If I interfere shifting to the right with shifting to the left with the right coefficient, I can make each shift to be larger than one by this interference. So this interference phenomena, which corresponds to having weak value that is larger than the maximum value, allow me to get in quantum mechanics a shift that is much bigger than the possible classical shift. And that's the explanation how you can get, by doing weak measurement, you can get things that behave much bigger than the classical limit. But there is a formula, a very interesting formula, that I would like to show you, that is called now, Michael Berry, when he heard for me this story, gave it a very nice name. He called it super oscillation. And I will show you how from this thing I got the idea that I can superpose long waves and get in a finite region a wave that is much, much shorter than any of them. And that's what Michael Bay suggested later to call super oscillation. So from the thing that came out from it is this beautiful formula, and let me show you how it is. When I do this experiment any time, and I'm successful any time to get the same answer, I found out the following formula. So let me now show you the formula without showing how it comes from this, and then you can, at home, try to see how I got this formula from doing n steps like this. Yes?
From this presentation, it's not clear what the number of steps n is doing here, because even after one step, you could get some outrageous weak value. So why?
Yeah, but I can't think in one step, because the only condition that I will get a weak value is to shift by much less than uncertainty. So how will I be able to see that this was this big shift for one experiment? I have to repeat this many times so that the final shift will be outside the uncertainty.
Okay, but even if you repeat it many times, you could make them independent repetitions, and that doesn't coincide with what you're talking about, one random walker, which is...
No, I can do it in two different ways. I can either do many individual experiments and collect only the time that I was successful, that indeed how it's done in the laboratory. I want to do something more dramatic. I want to take just a single particle, do this experiment n times, being successful all the times, and see what will happen to this individual particle if I had a very rare situation and was successful all the time. That's when I saw a classical coil. And I was successful n times, brings me one half to the n. A classical miracle. In this classical miracle, the particle moved a distance n times delta n, okay? Now I want to discuss a quantum miracle where I repeated n times my quantum coil and I got at the time the same answer. Then for this miracle I will go a distance that's much bigger than it turned out classically. That's what I'm after. I want to see what mathematics is behind it, okay? I want to show you that this mathematics that comes out of that have this new concept of super oscillation, okay? It's exactly what happens if you have an individual particle that n times the coin was successful to get the same answer. But you can forget about this and just look at this new mathematics by itself. Forget how I wrote it. But let me show you a beautiful mathematical formula that became because of this, but it has this beautiful property of super oscillation, which corresponds to this quantum miracle, okay? So let's look at this formula. I write f of x to be equal to 1 plus alpha over 2 times e to the I x over n plus 1 minus alpha over 2 e to the minus I x over n to the power n. Now I can look at this formula in two different ways if I'm interested in the limit when n becomes very large. One is I can do a binomial expansion and write this thing as equal to sum of n. The binomial coefficient n factorial over n factorial n minus n factorial. I have outside 1 over 2 to the n. And then I have 1 plus alpha to the power n, 1 minus alpha to the power n minus n, and then the coefficient e to the I, x over n, times n plus n minus n.
Could
be
minus.
Minus.
Capital N minus
N. So it's 2N minus N, right? Yeah. And I call this coefficient here KN. So I can rewrite this thing. I can write this f of x as the sum of CN times e to the I KNX where Cn is equal to this number. This is Cn. And the coefficient Kn is equal to 2n minus n divided by n. If n, little n is equal to big N, then this is equal to 1. If little n is equal to 0, this is equal to minus 1. That means that Kn, absolute value, is smaller than 1. Of the range of Kn, the range of Kn is larger than minus 1 and smaller equal to 1. All right? So I see here a sum of waves that have Kn, or wavelengths. The wavelengths are the shortest wavelength is 1, and I have a superposition of different waves, and the shortest wavelength is 1. Now I can look at this formula in a different way. I can look at x equal to 1 plus I plus alpha e to the I x over n plus 1 minus alpha e to the minus I x over n divided by 2 to the power n. I can expand e to the I x over n and look only for finite x that I can neglect the higher order x squared over n squared. So if I only keep the first order in the expansion here, I will get 1 plus alpha over 2 times 1 plus I x over n plus 1 minus alpha over 2 times 1 minus I x over n to the power n. And if n, if I go to the limit when n goes to infinity, keeping x fixed, I can neglect higher order theorem of x squared over n squared, and all of them. Now, what this is equal to, I see 1 over half here, and 1 over half here, so it's 1. And then I see plus I alpha x over n, and this to the power n. And that becomes e to the I alpha x, if n is sufficiently large. So if n is sufficiently large, the sum of these waves, that none of them, no kd was larger than 1, gives me e to the I alpha x, where alpha shall be much larger than 1. Because that thing will, that approximation will be valid even if alpha is larger than 1, provided that n is sufficiently large and x is finite. So I see here a very interesting possibility that I have a superposition of waves that are all the long waves, that shows that 1 is 1, and in a large region of space, I see a wave that oscillates much faster, like e to the I alpha x, right? And I can even go to the limit when n goes to infinity, and say that for every finite x, I will have e to the I alpha x. This seems to be a violation of the Fourier theorem that says that you cannot, that all these things are linearly independent. You can't have some of different cases to get a new case that is not one of them. How is it possible? Why didn't Fourier think about it? That there is a way actually to superpose small case and get a large case any point in it. The answer is that at this limit that I'm talking about, I have something new that is reminding us how the object got a delta function, but here we got a new situation where the thing that replaces the integrand in the Dirac case that was infinite only at one point, in this series something very interesting happened. If I look at the series Cn e to the I Kmx, and look at what these Cn's are at the limit when n goes to infinity. A particular Cn is 1 plus alpha to the power n, 1 minus alpha to the power n minus n. Now look at it at the limit when n is very large. I see, first of all, that if alpha is larger than 1, at least one of them grows up to infinity. If I go to the limit of n goes to infinity. For example, if I look here at little n going to, because this goes from 0 to n, if this goes to infinity, that thing becomes infinite. And that thing oscillates from plus 1 to minus 1, depending on when it's odd or even. Little n is odd or even. So I have now a sum. Well, each one of these coefficients is completely meaningless. It completes either plus infinity or minus infinity, and therefore the coefficients don't exist. But if I look at the sum, I found that it existed. So I have a limit here. As long as n is finite, each one of these things is well defined, and I can go just like Dirac did, or like it's done always in distribution, that you have a limit when you do the series. Before you go to the limit, you have a series that is well defined. And then you show that at the limit, each one of these coefficients don't exist, but the sum still exists. And therefore, this formula suggests a new kind of generalization of distribution, of the theory of distribution, that the coefficient never exists, and nevertheless, the series does exist. So it's new kind of mathematics. But even before we go to this limit, we see there is something very interesting. And that is, if we look at x, we can superpose long waves, and in a finite region here that is much larger than 1 over alpha, we have oscillations that are much, much faster than any of the oscillations in the original sum. And that's why there is suggested to call it super oscillation. We have a super oscillation coming about from superposing or a normal oscillation. We get in a finite region of space to make it as large as we like, we can get super oscillation. This has interesting experimental implication, but for us, the reason why this happened is because we see here the effect of the weak value of the step being larger than 1. The weak value being larger than 1 of the sigma z that was the origin for the step lead up to this oscillation. So we'll discuss more of this in detail next time, next lecture tomorrow. But I wanted just to give you a little bit of feel how you can get interesting new mathematics once you begin to look at new physical situations. So the new physical situations, we have pre-post selection that gives us weak values that are larger than the maximum eigenvalue, and this shows itself mathematically by superposing small waves and getting a large wave. So this is very nice how you can see new mathematics coming out from this new way to look at physics. So let me summarize what I've shown to you in this lecture. I've shown to you, first of all, that if we look at an ensemble on which we measure weakly each one of the particles in this ensemble, and we get something that mathematically is equal to the thing that later we call average, we can prove that the reason why it becomes average is because dynamically we can show that indeed the sum of the times we get different eigenvalues add up exactly to this psi psi, and then we can interpret it as the average. So this is a proof of the Bohm rule. Then we say we can do on this ensemble a post-selection by measuring some other operator and separate the ensemble according to pre and post selection situation. And then we show that what we get under this condition are some not of average or not of eigenvalues, but some of weak values. And the weak value now, I claim, is the most important way to think about quantum system that is being pre and post selected, interacting weakly with the environment. So it has this new property. This new property is the weak value, and in the next few lectures, we discuss all kinds of very interesting implications of this new physics. Okay? Thank you.
still tomorrow.
Huh?
Tomorrow is the same time.
Yeah, I'll go right there tomorrow.
Okay, cool.
It's the same room.
Same room. Please.
Yeah, same
room. Hey, 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 everybody. When I was giving lecture at the Leeuwen University, I had my lecture saying that if the next time the students don't come with these two interesting questions, I'm not going to have the talk.
Two questions.
So, this is the condition for tomorrow. With these two non-trivial questions.
Can they increase it to three?
Okay.
Right. Can they increase it to three?
These two questions.